Hi, listeners, and welcome back. We're going to do something a little bit different this time. Normally, we look at cases which have a final resolution. We go through a bit of the background facts, a little bit on the parties themselves, and then we discuss the merits of the arguments and work through a breakdown of the legal issues and decisions. We then look at what the final outcome was and try and make sense of the how and the why, what happened. So this time around, we're going to look at a case which is still ongoing. It's still in the middle. It's pending right now in federal court. So this is going to be the first part of a two-part series. I don't know when we're going to be able to do the second part because I don't know when the COVID trial ban is going to be lifted and this case can actually proceed to trial. But there's just so much packed into everything going on here that one 30-minute segment would not nearly cover this entire story. Those of you who listened to the episode on Casey Anthony and were blown away by the crazy fact pattern will really appreciate how far outside the norm this particular case goes. I'm Paul Townsend, the host and creator of In Summation, The Final Word. And in this episode, we're going to take a look at one of the strangest cases that I guarantee you've never heard of, but you should definitely keep an eye out for in the next few months as it ultimately is going to play out. We're going to look at how one human rights lawyer took on a massive oil company, won a fantastic international litigation victory, and has been subject to intense persecution ever since, using some really abstract legal oddities. Some people think he's the bravest human rights litigator in the world, taking on evil corporate oil giants who exploit those without access to the courts for monetary gain. Others argue he's a charlatan who fabricated scientific reports to extort a major oil company into roughly a $1 billion windfall for himself in legal fees. We're also going to look at the concept of what is the most appropriate venue to try a case in. I'll explain what the RICO law actually is and how it can apply to private people. We'll explore a little bit of the sacred bond of the attorney-client privilege and discuss how and when a private attorney can assume the full prosecutorial power of the Department of Justice and bring a criminal action against an individual person. This is the United States, but really Chevron Oil, versus Stephen Donzinger. Now, like I said, this is going to be part one of two. Stephen Donzinger currently has charges pending against him in the Southern District of New York Federal Court for contempt of court. For those of you who aren't lawyers, contempt of court means he directly disobeyed a court order. And Stephen Donzinger definitely directly disobeyed a court order. But in order to understand why the order was issued and why Donzinger flatly refused to comply with it, we have to go back decades to when the groundwork for this criminal contempt charge really began. Donzinger was born in 1961 to a politically active family. As a young child, his mother took him to picket the Cesar Chavez lettuce boycott. Throughout his childhood, his parents and grandparents would instill in him a deep sense of right and wrong and a burning desire to advance human rights causes. Donzinger was an exceptionally bright student. He graduated from American University with excellent grades and went on to Harvard Law School. While there, he befriended and played basketball with future President Barack Obama. But Donzinger did not go directly from college to law school. After graduating from American, he first became a journalist. He went to Central America and got a job doing investigative work for the United Press International in the capital of Nicaragua, Managua. After a few years as an investigative journalist, Donzinger returned to the States to attend Harvard Law and graduated in 1991, where he took a job as a public defender in Washington, D.C. While advocating for indigent defendants arrested on federal charges, in his spare time, he fulfilled his desire to work with human rights abuses on a more global level by authoring a report on Iraqi civilian casualties from the Gulf War that was ultimately adopted by the United Nations. While at Harvard, Donzinger had also befriended a fellow student of Ecuadorian descent who told Donzinger about the horrible conditions that oil companies had been inflicting on the people there. Now, with that background in mind, we get to the origin of his current legal issues, Our story begins in 1993, 2 years after Donziger had graduated law school. Donziger took a trip to Ecuador to see the conditions for himself. He later described the scene as an apocalyptic disaster. The roads and lakes in the jungle were covered in oil. Children were walking barefoot down the street, sometimes ankle deep in flowing oil. This was the Lago Agrio oil field. Donziger assembled a team of attorneys and filed a class action lawsuit in New York against Texaco on behalf of the 30,000 indigenous Ecuadorian residents affected. A quick aside on a topic called venue. When you want to file a lawsuit, you cannot simply file it in any court you want. The court must have jurisdiction to hear the matter. The most common scenario is that the lawsuit is filed where the actions giving rise to the lawsuit took place. In this case, that would mean that the lawsuit would have to have been filed in Ecuador. But without going into all the ways a party can argue that a court has jurisdiction, you can also file a suit against a corporation in the jurisdiction of its principal place of business. In this case, Texaco's headquarters were in New York, so Donziger and his team were legally permitted to file their suit there. Donziger's case was that Texaco's drilling in the Ecuadorian Amazon had resulted in massive contamination of the surrounding area. Texaco had been drilling in the Lago Agrio oil fields in Ecuador since the 1970s and had partnered with the Ecuadorian national oil company, Petro Ecuador. Long ago, Texaco had come to an agreement with the government of Ecuador to clean up some of the pollution it had caused. It paid $40 million to Petro Ecuador to orchestrate the pollution remediation efforts. 8 years after Donziger filed his lawsuit, in 2001, Chevron purchased Texaco and became the de facto defendant in the still ongoing lawsuit. Now, Donziger was suing Chevron. Cases of this size and magnitude take decades to move to trial. There were countless motions to dismiss, discovery arguments, fights over whether one party was entitled to certain materials from the other, generation of expert reports, countless depositions, and each decision on all of these critical issues might take a judge weeks or even months to make. So it was no surprise that at the time of Chevron's purchase of Texaco, the suit had still not been resolved. Chevron argued that Texaco's $40 million payment to Petro Ecuador absolved them of any liability, and now it was up to Petro Ecuador to fix the problem. Chevron's lawyers did not want to try the case in the Southern District of New York, where it was filed. While there's no direct line to what Chevron was thinking, it makes sense that they felt that giant oil companies were probably not especially popular corporate entities, especially among the New York City residents who would have made up a jury. So they filed a motion to move the case to the Ecuador courts, where they assumed the system would probably be a little friendlier to their interests. Chevron was not only a major employer in Ecuador, but it paid a lot of tax money to the Ecuadorian government. Chevron felt that the courts in Ecuador would likely be a little bit more favorable to their position. In 2002, the judge in the Southern District of New York ruled that Ecuador was the appropriate venue to try the case. Now, he extracted a promise from Chevron that it would abide by any decision of the Ecuadorian court and then moved the case there. This should be considered a pretty shrewd move by Chevron. Just because Donziger had the legal right to file his lawsuit in the Southern District of New York does not necessarily mean that the case had to stay there. Prior to trial, one party may make a claim that some other jurisdiction is a more appropriate place to oversee the case. And if the judge in the current venue agrees, they will simply pass the case off. Now, this doesn't happen too often, but lawyers do make this argument from time to time, especially if they feel the current venue is not so friendly. Chevron was able to argue that Ecuador had a more legitimate right to oversee the case, and the Southern District of New York agreed. Donziger was concerned about this move, and for good reason. He was worried that without a strong showing of public support, he'd never get a fair trial in Ecuador. So he decided to launch a public relations, or maybe more accurately, a public education campaign to get the word out about what Texaco, and now Chevron, had been doing at Lago Agrio. He starred in a documentary in 2009 called Crude, where he showcased the environmental and human rights catastrophes which the oil drilling had caused. The documentary also cited scientific reports and conversations with consultants and experts on the extent of the pollution and the effect on the indigenous peoples. The case went to trial in Ecuador in a provisional trial court in 2011. Donziger made the same arguments that were featured in the documentary. He claimed that the oil company's drilling had essentially devastated the area and caused irreparable harm for the indigenous peoples. He claimed that the pollution and contamination were a direct result of Texaco/Chevron's drilling. Chevron's lawyers argued that Donziger was a con man, that he was signaling out Chevron because the company had deep pockets, but that Petro Ecuador was really responsible for the pollution. Texaco had made good on its promise to help pay for the cleanup decades prior and bore no continuing responsibility. Chevron also claimed that the reports discussing how the drilling had caused contamination were suspect and had shaky foundations. Both the science and the methodology were bad, and that Donziger himself had anonymously written and submitted them into evidence. They had their own expert reports showing that their activity was not the cause of the pollution. In fact, Chevron made several public statements at this time, indicating that their whole long-term strategy was simply to demonize Donziger. They hired private investigators to track him. They created a publication to smear him in the public, and put together a team of literally hundreds of lawyers from 60 different law firms whose sole purpose was to find ways to harass him. Now, despite the extraordinary efforts by Chevron to paint Donziger as a greedy sleazeball intent on bilking a rich corporation, the Ecuadorian court awarded Donziger's class action plaintiffs $18 billion in damages. This figure was later reduced to $9.5 billion by the highest appellate court in Ecuador, but the Supreme Court in Ecuador also affirmed the result. Notwithstanding the promise that Chevron had made to the Southern District to abide by the Ecuadorian court's decision, Chevron immediately moved all of its assets out of Ecuador. The plaintiffs filed collection lawsuits on Chevron assets in Brazil, Argentina, and Canada. The courts in both Argentina and Brazil immediately dismissed the actions. In Canada, the courts held that the Canadian Chevron entity was legally different than the Chevron entity which was subject to the trial verdict and declined to force them to make payment. The plaintiffs kept fighting, but ultimately gave up the Canadian suit in 2019 when it became clear that Canada was simply not going to rule in their favor. To date, this judgment has still not been paid. Now we return to the United States, where shortly after losing the trial in Ecuador, the Chevron Corporation filed a RICO civil case against Donziger individually back in the Southern District of New York, where Donziger lives. Most people have some familiarity with the term RICO, but may not be familiar with what it actually means. RICO is an acronym. It stands for Racketeer-Influenced Corrupt Organizations. It is a federal law which was passed to stop mafia operations, largely in New York City, by holding each member of the criminal organization responsible for all of the criminal acts of the organization. So the idea was that this would force lower-level foot soldiers to turn on their superiors and become informants if they were all of a sudden responsible for all of the crimes committed by any member of their organization. It became possible to charge low-level mafiosos with murders, extortion, bribery, usury, money laundering, drug trafficking, and all manner of serious crimes that they had never taken part in just by virtue of their involvement with the crime family. It is considered an instrumental law in the dismantling of the deeply entrenched mafia families in New York in the 1990s. While RICO was passed specifically with an intent to combat criminal activities, it also became used in civil courts as well. A civil RICO case is a bit different, but the underlying framework is actually the same. In order to win on a civil RICO case, the plaintiff must prove that the defendant engaged in some racketeering activities which caused the plaintiff economic injury. Racketeering activities consist of wire or mail fraud, money laundering, extortion, bribery, that kind of thing. Chevron was accusing Donziger of bribing the Ecuadorian judge, fixing scientific studies and ghostwriting fabricated reports introduced as evidence so that he would fraudulently win a big judgment and collect massive legal fees. Chevron did not want this case to go in front of a jury, so they structured their requested relief so that a judge would hear the case. A defendant's right to have a jury hear a trial is only triggered when certain demands are made by a plaintiff, usually revolving around the amount of monetary damages being sought. By specifically not triggering those criteria, Chevron was able to ensure that a judge, rather than a jury, would make the final decision on the civil RICO case. The case was assigned to the Honorable Judge Lewis Kaplan. In 2013, Chevron arranged to bring an Ecuadorian judge named Alberto Guerra to New York. Chevron paid for immigration lawyers for him and his family, set him up with a New York City apartment, and paid him a monthly salary of $12,000 while he waited to testify. At the 2014 RICO trial, Alberto Guerra claimed that Donziger had arranged to have Guerra ghostwrite the judgment against Chevron and deliver it to the trial judge and then persuade him to adopt it. Guerra said for this, Donziger split $500,000 with him, taken from the plaintiffs. Relying on this testimony, Judge Kaplan found Donziger had indeed committed civil RICO. Judge Kaplan cited that Guerra had admitted to violating several laws, but that he still felt that Guerra's testimony regarding the bribery was credible. Kaplan described Donziger's actions as criminal, but the United States Attorney's Office declined to prosecute him. Donziger appealed the verdict. In 2015, while the case was pending appeal, Alberto Guerra testified under oath in an international tribunal. In his testimony, he admitted that he had lied and that he had changed his story multiple times in the Donziger RICO trial. He admitted that he had no evidence whatsoever that Donziger had ever paid him anything and that much of his prior testimony was either exaggerated or was simply untrue. He made it up. Donziger's lawyers made this a critical part of his appeal. But the Second Circuit, which hears appeals from the Southern District of New York, refused to consider Guerra's international testimony and unanimously upheld Judge Kaplan's ruling. To add insult to injury, because of Kaplan's ruling, Donziger was disbarred in the state of New York in 2018. With his license to practice law revoked, Donziger could no longer represent the Ecuadorian plaintiffs in their ongoing fight to extract the judgment money from Chevron. Donziger also appealed his disbarment. In February 2020, an independent legal referee considered the disbarment action and determined that it was inappropriate and too severe. This recommendation was to reinstate Donziger to the practice of law. That recommendation was sent to the New York appellate courts, but they ruled that the referee had been too lenient and upheld the disbarment in August of 2020. After giving his verdict in the RICO matter, Judge Kaplan had also awarded Chevron damages. He issued an order that Donziger had to submit his computer, his phone, and any other electronic device to Chevron in order to allow them to search for Donziger's assets. Donziger appealed this order as well. His chief argument was that submitting to this order would violate the attorney-client privilege, as he would be giving up confidential communications and information about the plaintiffs in the Ecuadorian case. Information which Donziger felt that Chevron wanted to use to intimidate them. This is another topic that shows up from time to time in TV and in movies. The attorney-client privilege is a big deal. Attorneys look at it the same way that a priest looks at what is said in a confessional or a journalist has a confidential source. You simply do not violate your client's trust like that. It's the backbone of the legal industry that clients can be open and candid with their counsel, and that whatever is said is confidential. And even if an attorney wanted to share privileged information, they would be subject to professional ethics violations if they do so. So attorneys take protection of privileged information very seriously, and Donziger would not turn over information which he considered to be privileged. Rightly or wrongly, Donziger believed that if Chevron was able to get access to the plaintiff's addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, employers, and other information, it would immediately begin a campaign to make life miserable for them until they gave up their rights to the Lago Agrio pollution judgment. Donziger categorically refused to comply with Judge Kaplan's order. And as a result, Judge Kaplan charged Donziger with 6 counts of contempt of court. What follows here piggybacks on a discussion we had when we looked at the General Michael Flynn case. There, the Department of Justice filed a motion to drop charges against Flynn, and the federal judge, Emmett Sullivan, declined to drop the case. This prompted a discussion about the separation of powers and federalism, and who ultimately has the authority to prosecute federal crimes. I put forth my own opinion that the separation of powers mandates that only the executive branch should have the power to pursue criminal charges, that the judicial branch is meant to referee, not to actually engage in prosecution. So what happens in the Donziger case? Judge Kaplan charges Donziger with contempt. Normally, in such a situation, the Department of Justice would come in and prosecute. They would look at the situation and determine that a valid judicial order has been issued, the defendant is refusing to comply, and it's pretty straightforward. It's a violation of the criminal code. So the U.S. Attorney's Office is the typical and appropriate agency to prosecute offenders. But something odd occurred in this case. Donziger refused to comply with Judge Kaplan's order. Kaplan issues an order that he be charged with 6 counts of contempt of court. But the U.S. Attorney's Office balked. They refused to charge him. A quick note, the U.S. Attorney's Office is part of the Department of Justice. So sometimes I use these terms interchangeably, and I don't want anybody to get confused. When I say the Department of Justice in this context, I mean the prosecutors at the United States Attorney's Office. So now we have another interesting federalism slash separation of powers question. This is slightly different than the General Flynn situation in that the Department of Justice is not seeking to drop a case after a guilty plea. They're refusing to start one. There is no prosecution yet, though a district court judge certainly wants there to be. Now, as strange as it is to believe, there is a minor procedural code which has been written into the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure which actually deals directly with this situation. Rule 42 provides that a person who commits criminal contempt will be punished after prosecution on notice. The court must request that an attorney for the government, i.e. the United States attorney, conduct the prosecution. But, and here's the key, if the government declines the request, the court must appoint another attorney to prosecute the contempt. So criminal contempt cases are, I believe, the only instance in which a federal judge can appoint a private attorney to handle a criminal prosecution. And that is exactly what happened here. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is an extraordinary thing. I've never personally seen it. I've never personally heard of it before this case. But in doing research, I have come across a very limited number of instances where this has taken place. I've mentioned before that the federal district courts in New York City are within the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. There are technically 13 appellate divisions in the federal system. 11 of these are the circuit courts. The 12th is just for the District of Columbia, and the 13th is for administrative agencies and federal trade courts. Each of the 11 circuits represent a different geographic area, and all 50 states are covered somewhere within the 11 circuits. DC, not being a state, gets its own separate circuit. If you were appealing a federal case out of Virginia, you would be in the 4th circuit. If you're in Pennsylvania, you would be in the 3rd circuit. There are anywhere from 6 to 29 judges which comprise the circuit courts, depending on the population of the circuit itself. Sometimes the circuit courts disagree on something, so the precedent set by the federal appellate courts in California, the 9th Circuit, may be different from the standard set in Oklahoma, the 10th Circuit. Often, disagreements among the circuit courts are what prompts certain issues to be heard and resolved by the Supreme Court, which then trumps any circuit court standing precedent. But the federal courts in the district are required to follow what their particular circuit court has determined the law to be on any given topic if no direct Supreme Court guidance has already been given. And the reason I bring this up is that different circuits have interpreted the Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 42 in different ways. Since 1985, the Second Circuit, where the Donziger case is taking place, has taken a very expansive view of the rule. The Second Circuit actually allows the lawyer of the civil counterparty in the contempt charge to be appointed to prosecute the defendant. That bears repeating. In the Second Circuit, which includes the Federal District Courts of New York, Connecticut, and Vermont, if a civil case results in a contempt charge and the Department of Justice declines to prosecute the case, the judge can appoint the lawyer for the opposing party to prosecute it. This gives them all the power of the federal government to obtain evidence in their case. Most other circuits have ruled that there is an inherent conflict of interest in this practice and have expressly forbidden it, but the Second Circuit has ruled that due process does not require a disinterested prosecutor. The order to show cause, which launched the criminal contempt case, was filed on August 5, 2019. An order was also filed on that day, transferring the case from Judge Kaplan to the Honorable Judge Loretta Preska. And as his last act prior to relinquishing the case, Judge Kaplan appointed Rita Glavin of the law firm Seward & Kessel as the stand-in prosecutor. Neither Judge Kaplan nor Seward & Kessel disclosed that the firm had close ties to Chevron, but I doubt that any listeners will be surprised to learn that Chevron had been a major and long-standing client of Seward & Kessel. Judge Preska's appointment here was a bit outside the norm for the Southern District of New York as well. Typically, when a judge has to pass a case along, as Judge Kaplan was required to do, the case will go into a pool and be randomly assigned to a new judge. But that's not what happened here. Judge Kaplan specifically transferred the case directly to Judge Preska. At the first appearance on the new contempt matter, Judge Preska determined that bail was appropriate to assure that Donzinger returned to court, despite never having missed an appearance since he began litigating against Chevron in 1993. Bail was set in the amount of $800,000, a portion of which was required as a surety and which was paid. As part of the conditions of Donzinger's release, he was placed under house arrest in August of 2019. He had to wear an ankle bracelet, surrender his passport, and report regularly to a pretrial supervision officer, which is similar to a probation officer. For those of you unfamiliar with the federal criminal court system, this is absolutely absurd. I currently have a client accused of engaging in a multi-billion dollar fraud scheme. He had bond set at $500,000, no house arrest, no GPS monitoring, and he doesn't even live in the same state as where the case is taking place. Donzinger has no criminal history. Up until 2018, he was a respected member of the bar. These extremely restrictive conditions of release are what we would expect to see for someone accused of multiple crimes of violence or who constitutes a real danger to society, not somebody who is refusing to obey a court order because he felt it violated the attorney-client privilege. Now let's talk for a second about the federal criminal contempt charge itself. We've already discussed that the willful disobeying of a lawful court order constitutes contempt of court. But the statute actually goes further to discuss the possible penalties associated with a conviction. If a defendant is convicted of criminal contempt, they face a fine of up to $1,000 and up to 6 months jail. That's it. It's now the end of February 2021 as I record this. Stephen Donzinger has been on house arrest since August of 2019. The case is still pending. He is unable to go to trial because of the COVID pandemic, but he has already been on house arrest for 563 days as of this recording, when the maximum penalty if convicted is 180 days jail. There is currently no timeline for when the trial can actually happen. So this is where we leave off in part one of the roller coaster known as the life of Stephen Donzinger. I'm going to follow up once the trial is actually concluded with information on his attorneys, more information on Seward and Kessel, some background about Judge Preska, and I'll explain a little bit more about the trial proceeding itself, whether it ends up being a jury trial, whether Judge Preska herself makes the determination. We'll examine the arguments and see who ultimately prevails. In summation, as I researched this case, I originally wanted to present a fair portrayal of Donziger's and Chevron's arguments. I wanted to give an unbiased account and let the listener decide who they felt had more merit. But the deeper down the rabbit hole I went, it just seemed more and more one-sided. Now, I will say that contained on some of the outtakes for Crude, the documentary Donziger participated in during his time in Ecuador, some experts did question whether Texaco's drilling was responsible for the pollution and contamination. That also supported Chevron's claims because the outtakes were not shown to the Ecuadorian jury. But on balance, Chevron's tactics of moving the case to Ecuador, attacking Donziger personally, refusing to pay the court's determination of damages after promising to do so, then accusing Donziger of bribery and extortion in the same court they had the original case removed from, producing a witness who was receiving a $12,000 monthly salary as well as immigration assistance to testify only to later recant his testimony and claim that he lied, all of this seems a little dark to me. I find it difficult to convey these facts in a way that doesn't make it seem like Chevron is acting inappropriately. But certainly, there are diehard apologists for both sides, and I welcome different points of view. So certainly, if listeners think that Donziger is not a saint, I'm willing to entertain those arguments. And if you want to have that discussion, feel free to email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. I do try and answer every email that I get, as I think all of you who have emailed me have seen. You can also tweet me at InsummationPod or find me on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Also, if you like the podcast, if you enjoy the explanations of legal concepts and arguments, then please rate and review it, and this will help other like-minded people find it as well. Thank you very much to Dan Townsend for doing the audio engineering and the background music. I look forward to covering part two of this saga when the Donziger contempt trial actually takes place. Until then, we have plenty of other cases to cover. But for now, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.